Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the latest installment of Close Readings. My name is Seamus Perry, and I teach English at Balliol College in Oxford, and I'm talking to Mark Ford, poet, critic, and professor of English literature at University College London. In this series, we are taking each time an individual poem, one chosen because it is, in one way or another, political, or about politics, or has been read politically. And our poem today is Yeats's great poem about the Dublin Uprising, Easter 1916. So, Mark, I suppose the first thing we could usefully do is say a little bit about the historical event that this poem memorialises.
Yes, I mean, this is the foundation of Irish nationalism in some ways. It propelled the movement towards freeing Ireland from British rule, which had been going on for many, many centuries. And as a sort of revolutionary event, it didn't really bear comparison with the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, in that it was almost aborted, really, by most of the main actors. And the bits of the revolution, the rising that did happen, they took over a biscuit factory.
All a biscuit tin.
As well as the post office, most kind of famously. They didn't take Dublin Castle, though in fact it was undefended. So in terms of the military strategy behind it, it was a kind of ragtag failed operation, and yet it becomes mythically the most important event in Irish history in the 20th century, and it's commemorated in 50 years on, 100 years on, and so on. So it is, and it obviously ties into ideas of the political martyr, that the 15 men who were taken out and shot afterwards, and that was the in some ways the key political event of it. It was the martyrdom of the 15 men, and then the following year Casement, who had been Roger Casement, been running guns from Germany in the hope of fomenting a revolution, is hanged in Britain. And so it becomes in Irish mythology absolutely crucial to the Irish Republican movement.
So these are deaths that seem, on the face of it, to be pointless and ineffective, but actually, with the passing of time, turn out to be redemptive and salvational. So I guess this is why Easter is flagged by Yeats in his title.
Absolutely. It was April the 24th, 1916, that it happened. And Yeats was profoundly troubled by it. I mean, he knew Padraic Pearse and he knew Thomas McDonagh. Obviously knew John McBride. All those three are mentioned in the poem. McBride had married Maud Gonne, but he was a drunken, vainglorious lout, according to Yeats. And there is evidence that McBride was abusive, possibly towards Isolt, her daughter, as well as to Maud. But Maud Gonne, who was a linchpin of nationalism, Irish nationalism, and disagreed with Yeats, who was much more wishy-washy, I think it's one way of putting it, in relation to whether or not violence should be used. There's an extent to which Maud Gonne does underlie the poem, and hers is the heart that's turned to stone in some ways. So it's both an elegy for the martyrs, as well as in some ways a refraction of his own disagreements with Maud Gonne. And in the process of writing it in 1916, he proposed, as I believe, to Maud Gonne again, and also to Isolt.
Yes.
So his obsession with the Gonnes was still up and running at this point, though he marries not that long afterwards. And it is, in some ways, a meditation on his own relationship to Ireland, his own relationship to republicanism or to nationalism. And it's deeply, deeply ambivalent in all sorts of interesting ways.
So the figure of Maud Gonne is an important one to keep in the back of our minds, isn't it? She's not referenced directly in the poem, is she? But she does become for Yeats an example of what a life might become if you allow yourself to be defined by your political beliefs, especially by your radical or your militant political beliefs. And I suppose one of the things that the poem calls into question is whether political commitment of that kind is worth it. So when Maud Gonne reads the poem, she writes a very cross letter to Yeats, doesn't she, saying she doesn't like the poem. It's not worthy of the heroism of the men who have died in it. She's so struck by the symbolism of the deaths that even though she's been separated from her horrible husband for 10 or 12 years or whatever it is, she assumes the name Maud Gonne McBride again, because he's kind of redeemed himself in a way by in this extraordinary uprising. So that sense of the ambivalence of political commitment or political dedication, that's an important element in the poems.
Yes, and it comes very early in his sort of responses to the event. There's a letter in May 11th in which he talks about how a terrible beauty has been born. So that phrase, which is kind of the crucial and one of the most famous sort of lines in poetry, a terrible beauty is born, captures his sense of the sublime nature or mythical nature of the events. And if you look at it in relation to Yeats's own kind of worldview, it's not that different from the way he presents, say, in Leader and the Swan, for instance, the descent of some kind of mythical power into the everyday, which transforms things altogether. So that was, or the Second Coming. So that was very kind of crucial to his understanding of history, was this... you could call it slightly, is the word crazy too much, that he does have this vision of some kind of supernatural event, not related necessarily to Christianity, but some all-transforming event suddenly appearing amidst the everyday. Mm. So this the first stanza, I've met them at close of day, coming with vivid faces from counter or desk among grey 18th century houses, puts us right in quotidian Dublin. Yep. And this is the petit bourgeoisie, isn't it? They're working in desks. They're almost like Dickensian clerks or something.
Absolutely.
And he knows them because everyone knows everyone in Dublin, and passes with a nod. And then in his aristocratic way, and he's being quite self-critical here, he presents himself as making a joke at their expense when he goes to his club, to which they would not be kind of entitled to membership. So part of Yeats's vision of Ireland was of a kind of aristocratic ideal and lots of nice, hardworking peasants. Mm. But he didn't like the middle classes, particularly the Catholic bourgeois middle classes. So one of the shocks the poem is registering is how these people who belong to the Catholic middle classes have suddenly been transformed into heroic visionary martyrs.
It's interesting, though, isn't it, that the terms in which Yeats thinks about their political martyrdom are aesthetic. Mm. So in other words, what's being born isn't really a political idea, is it? It's terrible. So, you know, the sorts of emotion that, let's say, famously Aristotle associates with tragedy, but also beauty. How do you think beauty fits into this sort of political landscape? It's a very, I mean, you're right, we're so used to this phrase. It's a very striking phrase, but it's odd that, in a way, Yeats should be so moved by the transformation of these lives into an aesthetic spectacle somehow.
I think the beauty derives from the act of transfiguration, so that, as with Leader and the Swan or the Second Coming or in this poem, the transfiguration of the ordinary into the extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the extraordinary being aesthetic, beautiful, powerful, sublime. It's a high romantic vision of the ways in which the divine can interpenetrate with the ordinary. Mm. But it's stripped of its kind of religious connotations and here connected to Irish nationalism. And Pearse and MacDonagh were both kind of cloudy, mystic nationalists, while James Connolly was a socialist and committed to kind of left-wing views. So there was a very, very different set of actors in the Easter Rising, and Connolly is not mentioned in the second stanza when he goes through four characters who would have been recognised by Dubliners immediately. And interesting on the Maud Gonne element is also is Con Markowitz, yep, or Constance Gore Booth, as she was born, who was pardoned because she was a woman. I mean, she was at St. Stephen's Green, and whether she fired or not, I think, is not clear. But there's a picture of her with a revolver, which kind of cements her image of herself as a kind of a revolutionary on the barricades. And Yeats had known her as a child. I mean, they were in Sligo. She had Sligo childhoods together. Mm. And here is this woman who has been, you know, who he is fairly critical of, that as with Maud Gonne, he feels, and this may make Yeats seem not that progressive in relation to sexual or gender relations, that her voice has grown shrill because she's been kind of, you know, she's haranguing people politically.
Politicised, absolutely. It's interesting that that's the first of the rebels that he mentions, isn't it? In the second verse, which gives us the little catalogue of what Yeats takes to be the principal players, and Con Markowitz here is clearly a kind of surrogate, isn't she, for Maud Gonne in a way? She is someone whose beauty has been destroyed by political engagement. That woman's days were spent in ignorant goodwill, her nights in argument until her voice grew shrill. What voice more sweet than hers? When young and beautiful, she rode to harriers. So her sweetness and her beauty has been destroyed by her political engagement.
And she's also betrayed her aristocratic kind of upbringing and ideals, you know, that we see her riding, going to harriers. It's riding with the hounds. It's chasing, you know, it's hunting. So here's this woman who could have been an icon of Irish aristocratic womanhood who has gone to the barricades. And that is seen as a betrayal. And I agree that to some extent she is not exactly a surrogate for Maud Gonne, but that they are linked in his mind as two people whose his vision of the ideal woman, and it is an idealization they have betrayed in some ways. But maybe that's how he likes it. It gets his poetry going. That's actually what works for him. To the extent to which he himself can present himself not exactly as a martyr, but as somebody who is suffering these betrayals,
yeah,
and the poetry comes out of some sense of betrayal.
Yeah.
And I think betrayal, as well as kind of visionary nationalism, is going on in this poem, and its ambivalence. Obviously, like Marvell's Horatian Ode, is what makes it such a great poem, because it isn't propaganda in any obvious way. In fact, he didn't circulate it after it was published because it would have been seen as kind of dangerous in some ways to the nationalist cause, because he still seems to believe that home rule is going to happen, that England may keep faith. But the idea of home rule was anathema to the Irish Republican Brotherhood and all good kind of, you know, Sinn Feiners. They didn't want home rule. They wanted independence. Mm. So Yeats, to that extent, like Marvell, is a bit of a trimmer in the way he presents his reactions to it. To the events, but he does say that they have changed things utterly.
Yes, the other participants in the uprising that he singles out are also, at least the next two, are kind of versions of himself, aren't they? In that they are both poets. Patrick Pearse, who founds a bilingual and English Gaelic school called St. Enda's, and Thomas McDonagh, who teaches there, and also I think was a lecturer at UCD. And it's interesting that what Yeats seems to single out is the fact that they are poets. This man had kept a school and rode our winged horse, which is rather a kind of circumlocutory way of referring to Pegasus, I suppose, who is associated with poetry and verse. The other, his helper and friend, was coming into his force, but into his force as a man of letters, into his force as a poet. He might have won fame in the end, so sensitive his nature seemed, so daring and sweet his thought, and their sweetness back again. That's what Con Markowitz had before she was sort of turned away from her true vocation as an object of beauty. So again, it's an interesting sort of dialectic, isn't it, here between the loss of beauty and the kind of recreation of a new and enhanced sort of beauty that replaces it.
Yes, and I think there's this element almost of envy as well in Yeats's, as one finds a lot in The Tower, and for the man of action, that increasingly in Yeats's life, after this period, he would celebrate the man of action in ways that are perhaps not always that edifying. But that what's astonishing to him are these sensitive poet figures who are committed to kind of Gaelic, and they wrote for the Abbey Theatre as well. I think they were involved in the literary circles, and kind of Yeats knew them from that. He may not have thought they were great poets, but they were part of that particular kind of cultural milieu. That these people could be transformed into men of action seems sort of utterly astonishing to him. And he wonders, on some level, you know, should he have done the same, or why could he not have done the same? Were they right to do these things? It profoundly affects his own sense of selfhood and the ways in which he was committed to Irish nationalism. I mean, I think we can think of Yeats almost as a post-colonial poet in many ways, though he spends so much time in London and in some ways is so embedded in London literary circles. Nevertheless, the overall drive of his career is the creation of an Irish literature, but not Gaelic. He wasn't, you know, he was, as our listeners will know, he was Protestant ascendancy. And to some extent, he was embattled as well, because this revolution not only sort of symbolised Irish nationalist cause kind of, you know, getting turbocharged, it also symbolised to some extent the beginning of the end, or a stage in the end of the Protestant ascendancy to which Yeats belonged, though he wasn't kind of, you know, wealthy or aristocratic as he claimed. He was kind of de classe, really. His father was a painter who never finished any of his paintings. But so there's all sorts of inner trouble that are, but the lines, they are so beautifully chiselled, aren't they? These vignettes in this kind of A-B-A-B trimeter rhyme scheme are so exquisitely formed. And he worked quite hard. There are earlier versions of these lines in kind of correcting them over the period in between circulating it in 1916 in a tiny private edition put out by Clement Shorter. And then it's published in the New Statesman. But not till 1920, so after, you know, things have really moved on. And then in Michael Robarts and The Dancer, it's collected. It's not in Wild Swans of Cool, which he thought about it. It could have been. So it's not 5 years until it gets collected. So he realised he was sort of handling sort of dynamite in some ways in this poem, and it was likely, it was a kind of minefield which he was kind of straying into. And the attack on McBride, this drunken, vainglorious lout, is then sort of reversed, isn't it? You know, yet he numbers him in the song. He too has resigned his part in the casual comedy, which is obviously the opposite of tragic beauty. A terrible beauty is born.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it takes us back to the world of inconsequential, self-ironizing conversation of the first verse. So the whole poem is this odd journey, isn't it, from a kind of inconsequential comedy of the mundane into something on a vast heroic and grand kind of scale.
Motley is what Motley is. Is the clown. These are clown figures.
Absolutely.
And suddenly they become tragic figures.
They become Hamlet or Lear or whatever it is they have become.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
You mentioned the Abbey Theatre a moment ago, which, of course, you know, Yeats has been involved very deeply with the theatre for the previous decade or more. And I'm quite struck that some of the words that we're using, some of the words we're taking out of the poem, like tragedy and comedy and motley and so on, this is the language of theatricality, isn't it? Is that something you see more generally in the poem, do you think?
Well, I think so, but also in the Easter Uprising. It was a terrifically theatrical event. In terms of its military significance, it was nugatory, but in terms of the theatre revolution, I think Lenin sort of spotted this and thought, this is, you've got to get the optics right if you're going to get a revolution going. You've got to get the mythology and the kind of the right sort of vision, the theatricality of it. So it's the theatricality of the vent and the way in which the poem itself stages it almost as a meta-theatrical event itself. And that it's like maybe a new thing in politics, the extent to which the way it's staged is what becomes the meaningful, is what generates the meaningfulness, the significance, and indeed the potency of the event itself. So that Yeats's own sense of the theatrical is sort of matched by the theatricality of the uprising itself and the ghastly way in which the British completely fail to grasp that. If they had grasped that and not shot the 15 men whom they shot, then possibly the East Uprising would have sort of sunk into history as a almost comically failed attempt at a revolution. But General Maxwell, in his wisdom, took them out and shot them in short measure and in the most gruesome of ways. Connolly was injured in the leg and had to sit down, and I think he was shot sitting down.
Mm.
What was his last words?
Oh, I can't remember. Something like, you may shoot me if you like, but I'm dying for my nation, or
yeah,
something along those lines.
Those are the sound bites that Maxwell should not have allowed out.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, of course, the real politic behind the poem is that what really transformed it into a triumph was the British.
Yes.
It wasn't the aesthetic magnificence of the gesture itself. It was the fact that these people were shot, 1,400 people were interned, and what was actually, if you read the histories, of, you know, fairly widespread indifference towards the whole thing amongst the population of Dublin, that disappears.
Yeah.
The population of Dublin is radicalised in an extraordinary way.
And you've got 100,000 Irish people fighting in the First World War for the British.
I know.
At Gallipoli and the Somme and so on. So it is one of those kind of paradoxes. I mean, it's the how imperialism plays itself out and how anti-imperialism or anti-colonialism plays itself out in relation to these paradoxes. And no one has captured the paradox more beautifully than in that line, "A terrible beauty is born," which, you know, obviously was the sort of trigger for the poem from that letter in May. But then he wrestles with the writing of it over the whole summer. Maud Gonne recalls him staying up all night writing it. Probably he recited it. That was his way. The Pound recalls how he'd recite in Stone Cottage, Uncle Willie in the chimney corner. So possibly he recited "A Terrible Beauty is Born." And he finishes it at Cool Park in September 1916. And that is after, that date is after the poem when it's published. And Lady Gregory, I think, did have a significant influence on the ways in which he understood the East Uprising and created this kind of moderate view, you could say, of it. But one which, I mean, every stanza apart from the third one ends with "A terrible beauty is born," to create this almost this mnemonic, this kind of mantra almost, which sums up this transfiguration or transformation, which is the pure Yeatsian concept of imagination. Imagination, this is what it does. It transforms, it transfigures. And here it's happening in life.
It lures you by a kind of reiteration into a sort of trance of some kind, often, isn't it? The way he describes it in the prose. You mentioned the third verse there. And that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because we suddenly get a different kind of language, a different kind of imaginative space, where he's thinking about natural images or images from pastoral or bucolic life, which seem to imply a kind of freedom, which doesn't feel particularly like a political freedom, but a kind of freedom that can characterize a life that hasn't been distorted by a kind of single singleness of purpose that he thinks nationalism inflicts upon the heart. The horse that comes from the road, the rider, the birds that range from cloud to tumbling cloud, minute by minute they change. A shadow of cloud on the stream changes minute by minute. A horse hoof slides on the brim, and a horse plashes within it. The long-legged moorhens dive, and hens to moorcocks call. Minute by minute they live. The stone, that's the heart, that's been petrified, as it were, by political commitment. The stone's in the midst of all. It's a different language, isn't it, from the rest of the poem? I'm always very struck by,
yes,
by that.
Yes, it's that brilliant mixture of both, you know, brilliant realist pastoral kind of observation, but the stone is allegorical. So they belong to sort of different registers. And he uses all his brilliant use of chiasmus, you know, the way he turns minute by minute they change, changes minute by minute. That kind of patterning, which is so intricate and beautifully matches this rather idyllic vision of kind of pastoral life, and it possibly kind of is a version of the cool park, you know.
Yes, it seems like it, doesn't it? Yeah.
It's not you know, raw, untamed nature.
It's not Phoenix Park.
No. So this living stream is this kind of idyllic island, which is kind of aristocratic and feudal in, but that's kind of buried under it. Mm. But it then has this allegory of fanaticism destroying his vision. And he did, that was his initial response to the uprising, that this has destroyed everything that we've been working for, that this has somehow turned the tables in some cataclysmic way, and none of his vision of an Irish nationalism, which would escape kind of Catholic martyrology. Maud Gonne had appeared in Kathleen Ni Houlihan, hadn't she? She'd been Kathleen Ni Houlihan. So his relationship to Irish national mythology goes back to his very earliest poems, Wanderings of Ushan, and so on. And this somehow, the raw violence of this event and the messiness of it contradicts all that he'd sort of believed in. So what does he do? He turns it into a poem which somehow fits it into the Yeatsian schema. Yeah. And even these louts, the drunken vainglorious lout, even MacBride, who fought in the Boer War against the British, which is why one reason Maud Gonne, who was Anglophobic in the most kind of extreme ways, was drawn to him. So the personal charge, I think, in relationship to Gonne is very strong in that stanza, which is only 16 lines long. Is an interesting form of the poem. It's 16 lines, the first stanza, 24 the second, then 16, then 24. The date, 1916, April the 24th, fourth of the month, four stanzas. I think Yeats did have this kind of
numerology thing going on,
and that all ties in with his compulsion to make a pattern out of chaos.
Yes, order. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's interesting, though, isn't it? The note on which the poem ends seems to be one of a kind of equivocation rather than final kind of rhetorical control or authority. We know their dream enough to know they dreamed and are dead. And what if excess of love bewildered them till they died? I mean, this is a very odd language in which to celebrate political heroism, isn't it? It's a dream. So in a way, Yeats is saying that whatever it was that they were engaged in was in some senses illusory.
But so much
and they
of
were
his
bewildered.
Yeah, but he was away with the fairies himself fairly often. So dreams,
not these fairies.
But dreams have quite significant sort of validity for Yeats as a sort of vehicle for knowledge. You know,
dreams are also sooth, as he says, one of those.
Yes, and all the kind of Order of the Golden Dawn and all the kind of table rapping and the seances and so on. And it's interesting that he figures himself in the whole process whereby they achieve their status. I write it out in a verse, because he's also in this poem thinking, I think, well, what part should I be playing in this? And, well, I can be the national bard in some ways, and my ambivalences won't necessarily contradict my ability to write out their names in a verse. And it is chiselling their names into history. Many people will come across McDonagh and MacBride and Connolly and Pearse through this poem, if they're not kind of historians of Irish nationalism. I write it out in a verse, McDonagh and MacBride and Connolly and Pearse, now and in time to be, wherever green is worn. And he's here referring to the most standard cliche of Irishness, of the wearing of the green, you know, which was a kind of ballad of the time, are changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. And all the stanzas, apart from the third one, end with this, a terrible beauty is born, as a kind of mantra. And that does leave, what's the emotional drive, do you think, by the end of it? What do you feel?
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? Because whenever a poet repeats a line, you're immediately invited to think about the ways in which those usages differ one from another in some subtle way. I mean, that's why refrains are so great, isn't it, in ballads and so on. Perhaps I've really betrayed what I think about this. It seems to me that the first time we get that kind of quasi-refrain of a terrible beauty is born, it feels extraordinarily kind of grand and heroic and statuesque. But by the time we get to the last version, at least this is my reading, it feels that it's couched in a syntax you know, these rhetorical questions, what if excessive love bewildered them till they died, which kind of rather undermines or kind of qualifies or perhaps equivocates on that rather heroic kind of sort of strident stance of the earlier uses of the line.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, earlier in that stanza, you've seen the normal kind of modes of elegiac celebration have kind of haven't worked.
Yeah.
That he appeals to heaven, heaven's part. When may it suffice? That is heaven's part. But actually, Yeats isn't a particularly a believer and doesn't believe in some kind of religious narrative. Our part to murmur name upon name as a mother names her child. And he's almost like a sort of, it's like a rosary, I think, almost murmuring these names in some way on when sleep at last has come on limbs that had run wild. What is it but nightfall? So this gentle elegiac kind of trope of that they've fallen asleep. No. No, not night, but death. So there's a kind of the realism kind of kicks in there. And then was it needless death after all? So the narrative of home rule, which had been passed, it had been passed through Parliament, but they put it on hold until the war was over.
Which so, they thought would happen quite quickly.
Yes. England may keep faith. Well, this was anathema to Irish Republicans for all that is done and said. And then he cuts back to the dream, which is in some ways where he's more comfortable, relocating them in a kind of dream of transformation. I mean, I think that to that extent, at the end, the terrible beauty is born seems to me a meta-poetic statement that poetry can do these things, and an utter kind of celebration of the Yeatsian, of his own power to write out their names in a verse and embed them in the pantheon of the Yeatsian, and that itself is the tribute the poem plays to them without undermining their kind of without overlooking their difference from him. But this decisive moment of action has transformed them in some way, which enables them to enter the Yeatsian pantheon.
Yes.
Well, that would be a slightly self-serving way of figuring it, perhaps. But I think Yeats's imagination, when it worked, did function in that motion, that concept of transfiguring everyday experience into the heroic and into the Yeatsian.
Yes, and there is that whole side of Yeats, isn't there, that that agrees with the symbolists that the world exists primarily to be put into a book.
Yes. So whatever you say about the Easter Uprising, it ends up giving rise to a poem which is in some ways more politically dealing with the everyday politics in a way that's actually not that typical of Yeats up to this point. So this is a transformational poem for his own career. I mean, he's, 51 at this point, isn't he? So, and after this, his work does become insistently political. And it takes the notion of the hero in directions which are not necessarily divorced from the rise of fascism towards the end of his career.
Dennis Donoghue's got a very good phrase in his excellent little book about Yeats where he says that Yeats became a great poet because of what he thought of as his weakness, which was a weakness for reality.
Yes.
He wanted to stay in the world of dream, but actually he found it was impossible.
He
regretted it.
Yeah.
But it's the qualified dream vision that is the great Yeats. And I suppose, as you say, it's Easter 1916 and poems of this period that see the birth of that complicated Yeatsian voice.
And, I mean, there are some excellent pieces in the LRB. We should, particularly Terry Eagleton's one is extremely kind of sharp, but also ones by Frank Kermode. And I think that they're related also to his origins in reading Shelley and Blake. I mean, the origin of A Terrible Beauty is possibly Fearful Symmetry from Blake's Tiger, Tiger, a similar kind of contraries and antagonisms, and that his imagination works in that kind of Blakean way. And like a Shelley poem, like The Mask of Anarchy, it takes an event and creates a poem in a sort of ballad style out of it that is complex and sophisticated, as well as kind of very, very memorable.
Thank you. Our next conversation will be about quite a different political poem, Elizabeth Barrett Browning's Runaway Slave at Pilgrim's Point. If you enjoyed this episode, please do try signing up to the Close Reading subscription, where you'll find our full 12-part series on 19th and 20th century long poems and short stories, The Long and Short. and lots of other things as well. There's the full series of Medieval Beginnings with Irina Dumitrescu and Mary Wellesley, and Among the Ancients with Emily Wilson and Thomas Jones. And there are three new series running this year: On Satire with Colin Burrow and Claire Bucknell, Human Conditions with Judith Butler, Pankaj Mishra, Brent Hayes Edwards and Adam Schatz, and a second series of Among the Ancients with Emily Wilson and Thomas Jones. And even more, you can hear the first series that Mark and I did together on modern and modern-ish poets, and listen to this series on political poems without any annoying ads. So please do give it a go. You can sign up directly in Apple Podcasts or in other podcast apps. Just follow the links in the description.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.